It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. We've learned a few things about Lyme disease since a doctor in Connecticut first diagnosed it in children 40 years ago. We know that it's often transmitted by deer ticks in the spring and summer. We know that tens of thousands of people come down with Lyme in a typical year, making the disease the second most commonly reported infectious disease in the region. And we know Lyme can be extremely serious for those affected, from fatigue and flu-like symptoms to arthritis, mental problems, and occasionally death. But there's still much we don't know about Lyme disease, and that's led to a large and often contentious divide. Many doctors insist the evidence shows Lyme can largely be treated with a relatively short course of antibiotics. But many who have Lyme say their symptoms have persisted beyond that initial treatment and that it takes a long-term approach to stop a painful and debilitating condition. Boston Globe reporter Beth Daly has been peering into this divide, trying to understand an often frustrating disease and why people disagree so strongly over how it's handled. Beth Daly joins us today to talk about what she's learned and about whether we're changing our understanding of this disease or if we're simply in for more debate. Today on The Exchange, Lyme disease, what we know, what we don't, and why the controversy around it continues. And let's hear from you. Have you or has someone you know had experience with Lyme disease? If so, what was the treatment like? If you're a member of the medical community, what has your experience been with Lyme disease? What more would you like to know when it comes to Lyme? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a question or comment through our Facebook page. Our guest for the hour is Beth Daly. She's covered the environment for the Boston Globe since 2001 and has won numerous national journalism awards, including being named a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2008. She's working on a series of stories about Lyme disease for the Globe called Bitten by Uncertainty. And Beth Daly, it's great to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Often with a high-profile disease, we feel like we know a great deal about it. I don't get that feeling with Lyme disease. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a great assessment. I too, have heard of Lyme and thought I knew what it was. And in fact, I knew nothing. And it's one of the most vexing and complex diseases out there and controversial. And it's not just Lyme. There's a lot of other there's at least four other pathogens that tick and transmit to humans that are still emerging and scientists are just learning about.
And you did wind up learning about Lyme disease and then the controversy surrounding it in a very painful and personal way through someone very close to you.
Yeah. A relative of my husband's first cousin's wife, who is a wonderful friend, committed suicide last April, after, you know, basically being this completely energetic, wonderful, smart, outgoing teacher, mom, she was sort of the hub in Northampton and Florence for the community. And in 2010, she suddenly and inexplicably became incredibly ill. I mean, this is a woman who used to run marathons for fun and bicycle at Mount Washington, suddenly couldn't even get out of bed. And she became foggy. Her brain became foggy. They had no idea what it was. They went from doctor to doctor to doctor. They tested for Lyme. It came back negative several times until she sort of entered this sort of very confusing world of Lyme and went to a doctor that interprets results far more liberally than what the federal government recommends, and came to the conclusion that she might have Lyme. And she adopted this diagnosis and began treating herself with intravenous antibiotics and felt better, so much better. She was dancing at a party. She felt she was on the mend, but they stopped working. And in a fit of depression and insomnia last April, she took her own life, fortunately.
And that story is one that you hear oftentimes as people are discussing Lyme, that that people will say their treatment and their experience does not fit with the traditional regimen. Can we first start with, and you mentioned that Andrea's doctors tested a number of times for Lyme and interpreted the results differently. How do we test for Lyme, and why does it then come down to interpretation?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And so the way we to see if you have Lyme. Let's say you get by a tick. And if you don't have, the first thing doctors need to look for is something called a bullseye rash. And if they see that, you know, everyone agrees, look, you probably have Lyme. Go get some antibiotics right away. But what happens is not everyone gets that rash, and not everyone notices it, or the rash doesn't look exactly classic. And so many doctors rely on diagnostic tests to determine if someone has Lyme, and that's where the problem lies. Unlike, they're not really testing when they test your blood. They're not testing for the bacteria itself. They're testing for your basically the antibodies in your immune system that are fighting the infection. Now, the problem with that is twofold. One, early on, your body may not be producing enough antibodies to show up on a test. So you could take a Lyme test and be negative. Later on, after your body has, you know, produced antibodies, those antibodies may linger. Just like if you had chickenpox, you would have antibodies in your body for chickenpox for a long time. They would linger for a very long time, resulting in some false positives later on, long after the infection has been cleared for your body. So on both sides, you may have Lyme and the doctors say no, or the doctors may say you have Lyme and you actually don't. So there's a problem on both ends.
I remember reading that it took several years for people investigating what was going on in Lyme, Connecticut, to pin down what exactly was going on. So this itself is not new.
Right, exactly. I mean, and Lyme is like, they call it the new great imitator, and they call it syphilis, which is also the same kind of bacterium. It's called a spirochete. It's sort of like this corkscrew-shaped bacteria that can that gets inside your system. It's just the reason why it took so long to figure out is that Lyme, you know, you could have a headache from Lyme. You could have a backache. You could have Bell's facial palsy, which is a big symptom of sort of a later stage, is that half your face or your entire face can be in paralysis. You could have heart problems. You could have arthritis. And so what happened way back in 1975 is a couple of mothers in Lyme, Connecticut had seen a lot of kids that had arthritis. And it was a really weird diagnosis to have so many kids with arthritis and all these other unexplained symptoms. And they, through a series of events, found their way to Dr. Steer and some other people, Dr. Alan Steer, who is credited with discovering Lyme. And he was at Yale at the time, and presented him with this information. And he then did his own work and found out that, you know, there's something going on here. There were children that had arthritis at levels that were just, you know, off the charts. And then what began an investigation that ultimately resulted in 1982 was that the spirochete was found to be the cause of that.
And there are summers where people and animals seem to be at greater risk for Lyme disease than others.
Right. Yeah, ticks, you know, ticks have a complicated life cycle, but ticks love it hot, and they love it hot, and they also like a certain type of humidity. So some years are worse than others. Some people proclaim to forecast it, though I've not really seen a super reliable forecasting tool for ticks. Last year was a very severe year. This year, some people are saying is going to be as severe a year. But I think we just don't know yet. And the one thing about Lyme and ticks is, unlike mosquitoes where you could say, oh, it rained and there's lots of standing water, it'll be a bad mosquito year, ticks are very localized. So whether or not they have, I should probably explain the life cycle, but whether or not they're infecting an area can be very geographically centric, meaning it could be really bad at one person's house, but not bad next door. And that's because ticks tend to get the disease from white-footed mice. And white-footed mice carry the bacteria. Ticks in their larval stage, when they're tiny, tiny, tiny things in leaf litter, will latch on to mice and become infected. They'll fall off. That's like their first blood meal. They'll fall off. They'll wait a year or so, and then they'll reemerge the following spring, usually around, you know, late April, May, as nymphs. And these things are still very small. They're only like pinhead size, about the size of a period at the end of a sentence, or a lot of people now say the size of a poppy seed on a poppy seed bagel. And those are the ones that really tend to latch onto humans for their second blood meal. And again, where they are really depended on probably where the mice were originally. So let me follow this through. So they latch onto a human or another animal, a bird, you know, lots of things, to get a second blood meal. And then they'll fall off again, And they need one more blood meal, females do, to reproduce. And that's when they'll probably latch onto a deer. That's why they're called deer ticks or black-legged ticks. A lot of them like to use deer to latch onto for their last blood meal. And deer will go all over and can sort of have that tick drop off any number of places and sort of start the whole cycle again. But as you can see, it's not like an evenly distributed thing. So when people say it's a bad year, you have to realize that it's not true everywhere. You just have to figure out if it's a bad year where you are.
Today on The Exchange, the widening divide over Lyme disease, a series by our guest, Boston Globe reporter Beth Daly, explores how the tick-borne illness continues to spread across the Northeast, all while doctors are increasingly divided over how to handle it. The Exchange phone number, if you'd like to call with a question or comment, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Beth, we have a number of callers on the line already. Ryan is calling from Dover. Hi, Ryan. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your question?
Well, more of a statement, I guess, but you sort of touched upon a little bit of it, and it's been my frustration as well. I was diagnosed recently with Lyme disease. I'm 39 years old and really good health, but about 4 years ago, I presented with a huge rash on my chest, and I didn't think anything of it. I had a newborn kid. I didn't have time to deal with, you know, something. It went away after a couple of days. A few months later after that, I was hospitalized with a really bad fever, 102. They tested me for Lyme and for meningitis, for bird flu. All came back negative. Fast forward about a year after that, my right knee filled up with fluid. Went away after about a week or two. Didn't end up going to the doctor. Until finally, I sort of said to myself, I did a little bit of research online, and went to the doctor. I said, you know, I've had these things happen over the past couple of years. I'm really healthy. What's going on? I think I might have Lyme disease. And this was a primary care doctor, and she kind of dismissed me and almost laughed at me. And she said, well, you know, you can go get tested, but, you know, we're not even going to know if it's going to come back positive, if you really have it, and kind of made me feel like an idiot. So I ended up not going.
And that's that controversy that we heard. We're going to have to take a quick break here, Ryan. But when we come back, we'll ask Beth Daly to weigh in on your experience. And we'll also hear from more of our listeners. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. There's more to come. Stay with us here on The Exchange on NHPR.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And our job at NHPR is to bring to New Hampshire the most complete stories about New Hampshire. Whether it's developing a new story or expanding the range of perspective of an ongoing story, you can help. Join our Public Insight Network and let us know which stories we should speak with you about. Find out more about PIN at nhpr.org. More on the widening of the Lyme disease divide on The Exchange, then a 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, demonstrations in Brazil. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Systems Plus Computers, providing Apple computers, iPads, ThinkPads, PC software, plus setup and accessories, with locations in Hanover, Lebanon, and at systemsplus.com. And the Music Hall of Portsmouth, featuring concerts, comedy, cinema, and authors all summer, including Wynton Marsalis in concert Thursday, June 27th. Tickets at themusichall.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, we're discussing Lyme disease and the controversies surrounding it. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR, or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guest for the hour is Beth Daly, who has been covering the environment for the Boston Globe since 2001 and is working on a series of stories on Lyme disease for the Globe called Bitten by Uncertainty. We have a link to Beth's series at our website, nhpr.org. Beth, just before the break, we heard from Ryan, who called from Dover, and he talked about his experience. He got the rash. He had some of these other symptoms that presented themselves later on, and he said when he went to his primary care doctor, she was not convinced that Lyme disease was the case, and therein lies a lot of the controversy that we're talking about today.
Yeah, I mean, I feel really bad for Ryan. I mean, here's the trouble, is that there's so much confusion on the front line, because you have the CDC having these, you know, fairly strict rules about how to diagnose Lyme, or guidelines, I should say. They're not rules, they're guidelines, but most doctors adopt them wholeheartedly, because who else are you going to rely on other than the experts? And yet there's this other side, there's this other, you know, very vocal community of Lyme patients who say, hey, Listen, don't buy into the CDC criteria. They're really interpreting it way too strictly, and you have to follow basically your, you know, the symptoms. You have to look at the symptoms to diagnose this. Don't rely so much on the test. And the problem is with both those thoughts is that doctors on the front line get really, really confused. They get scared of the word chronic Lyme. They hear, you know, through newsletters and through the press that there's all these people who may have chronic Lyme that really don't, and, you know, they're making it up. So they tend to be very dismissive, I think, of patients overall, not because they don't care about the patients, but because they don't know what they have, and I think they can't. They don't know how to deal with the symptoms. In essence, so, you know, it sounds like Ryan had a really tough time dealing with this, and he may have Lyme, right? He may. We just don't know because the diagnostics are not great.
Ryan, thanks so much for your call. You can join us as well at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. I want to take a moment now to look at how New Hampshire is dealing with Lyme disease. And joining us to talk more about that is Beth Daly. And yes, you heard that right. She is also named Beth Daly. This Beth Daly is Chief of Public Health's Infectious Disease Surveillance Section at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And Beth, it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone.
As we've heard, the Northeast has always been a center for Lyme disease cases. Can you tell us about the situation in New Hampshire and how has that been changing? Is there a trend one way or the other in the number of cases here?
Sure. So we consider Lyme disease to be a very important issue here in New Hampshire. It is our second most commonly reported infectious disease. It has been reportable in New Hampshire since 1990. In the 90s, we saw about 20 to 40 cases per year, and then that has increased a little bit in the early 2000s with maybe 100 to 300 cases per year. But since 2006, we've pretty much seen a dramatic rise in the number of infections, going from about 600 in 2006 to about 1,600 in 2008, which was our peak.
Wow.
Last year in 2012, we reported 1,460 infections. Now, there are some caveats, which is that, as you've been talking about, the diagnostics around Lyme disease can be complex, and providers, you know, may or may not test their patients. So over this whole, you know, 20-year time frame, there could be differences in how frequently providers are testing. So basically, more testing could result in more reported infections. However, we do think there probably is a true increase in the infection itself, just based on this dramatic increase.
And now we heard Beth Daly from the Boston Globe talking about there's a lot that we still don't know about this disease. And I understand that the state now can classify someone as having probable Lyme.
That's correct. Back in 2008, the CDC and the Council for State and Territorial Epidemiologists made a change in the case definition for Lyme disease. And I do just want to point out that this case definition is for surveillance purposes and is not necessarily meant to guide clinical diagnosis per se. So just in terms of having a standardized way to count cases, we added a probable case classification, which basically allows more people to be counted as a case from a surveillance statistical standpoint, because typically we like to have people presenting with erythema migrans or some other clear symptom along with the positive Western blot laboratory testing. But what has the probable case definition has allowed for is for us to accept just in general a clinical diagnosis of Lyme disease in conjunction with the positive Western blot.
Now, besides tracking the spread of the disease and collecting data related to it, what else does your department do in regards to Lyme disease here that might help, say, prevent future cases?
Sure. So when diseases are made reportable in New Hampshire, it's usually because there's a very specific public health action that needs to take place. For example, if someone has meningitis, we would recommend antibiotic prophylaxis to their contacts. Lyme disease is a little different because there's not a specific intervention that we can do on each individual person. So most of our role here is gathering the data and then pushing it back out to the public and to healthcare providers to inform their decision-making and hopefully to take preventive measures. So in that regard, we do We do a clinician health alert network kind of advisory annually, which provides to them information on tick-borne diseases, the treatment, diagnosis, whether they might want to consider how they want to handle patients who have had a tick bite but don't necessarily have Lyme disease yet, and then also the prevention messages that they should be giving to their patients.
And do you find that people are getting messages about how to prevent Lyme here?
Well, we hope so. We don't actually have a way for tracking that. In addition to messaging to providers, we do an annual press release on Lyme disease and post a lot of data to our website as well as fact sheets telling the public how they can prevent Lyme disease, which I think the public actually receives a lot of these messages. It's just a matter of them weighing the inconvenience of, for example, using DEET or wearing long sleeves or doing a tick check every day against their risk of getting an infection.
Is there more that you would like to know about Lyme disease? As you know, there's this controversy around it and around the treatments. Is there more that you would like to know that might make your job a little easier?
Well, I am not an infectious disease physician. I'm the person who's kind of responsible for tracking the numbers. So I'm not really sure exactly what you're looking for me to tell you.
Oh, I'm just saying that that as you try to prevent future cases, does that controversy make your job more difficult?
I don't think so, because the prevention measures don't change regardless of the clinical presentation of Lyme disease. So we still would tell people to prevent tick bites, basically.
Okay. Beth Daly, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Beth Daly, Chief of Public Health's Infectious Disease Surveillance Center section of the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. We'd like you to join us here on The Exchange as we talk about the widening Lyme disease divide. The Exchange phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest for the hour is also named Beth Daly. She has covered the environment for the Boston Globe since 2001 and has won numerous journalism awards, including being named a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2008. Her current series is on Lyme disease for the Globe. It's called Bitten by Uncertainty. And Beth Daly, we've touched upon this a number of times, but let's just state out the more common approach, the traditional approach that's used, that's endorsed by the medical community at large, is a one-time treatment of antibiotics.
Right. Let me just back up with something, the other Beth Daly, which I find hysterical. I've never heard another Beth Daly.
Even we haven't heard that one in our many years on the air.
Is that one thing just to keep in mind, that Lyme disease is, according to the CDC, is 5 to 10 times underreported. And while the CDC is working hard to try to include more probable cases, which they basically assume to be cases, I mean, I've talked to them, is that it's still, you know, really, there's still probably at least 5 times as many people, and as many as 10 who got it, that are not sort of being captured in the by the CDC. So it's a lot more prevalent than people probably realize. Let's go talk about the how you treat Lyme. So the one big debate is about the diagnostics. How do you know who really has Lyme? And that's a very important question, because it's not clear. A lot of people one thing is absolutely clear is that there's a lot of really sick people out there. Do they all have Lyme? We don't know. I mean, many of them are convinced they do, and I'll defer to them, but the science isn't always there to support that claim. And so, but the diagnostic test is so not good. So that's one big problem. The other problem is a belief by the Lyme community, and some emerging science that lends credence to this, is that Lyme disease can be a long-running infection, meaning that according to the CDC and something called the Infectious Diseases Society of America, sort of like the preeminent infectious disease docs, say, look, you only need, on average, unless it's really late stage Lyme, you know, like a month or less of antibiotics, and you'll be fine. Yet the Lyme community says, listen, that's not true at all. You can have Lyme that persists. The infection sort of hides out in your body and can flare up again and again. And 1 month of antibiotics is nowhere enough to cure some people. And these people have feel very, very strongly that they need long courses of antibiotics or other treatment to really beat back Lyme, either completely get cured of it, go into remission, or, you know, just kind of be on long-term antibiotics just to feel better. It's clear they are feeling better from these antibiotics, but what the medical establishment says is, well, we don't know why you're feeling better because we don't know. We did some tests for looking at antibiotics. They were not, you know, conclusive. And plus, we don't even know if you have Lyme in the first place, so we can't really capture you in a study. So the one thing, I hope this is not too confusing, but one thing that everyone agrees on, that up to about 25% of people who are treated for Lyme disease continue to report feeling unwell for some period of time. Some people, some a week, others, you know, years. Why those people remain feeling poorly is unknown. Some hypothesis is, one, it's some sort of autoimmune reaction in your body. Sort of you get the infection and then your body kind of like has this autoimmune reaction that basically, you know, fighting itself. So that's why you feel bad. There's a persistent infection hypothesis. And then there's also something doctors know less about, but it's sort of like sometimes people get sick and they just don't get better. Sort of they get this nerve problem, this sort of pain amplification thing that makes them very, very sensitive to pain afterwards.
And to further cloud the issue, there was a study I remember reading about last year that said that some people who reported having chronic Lyme may actually have gotten a second infection, which,
exactly.
Just because we need more theories with this. We got an email a moment ago from Wendy who said, as a writer, I've interviewed victim, and let's call them what they are, after victim, who has been infected with Lyme disease and who has suffered greatly at the hands of the medical community in New Hampshire. She says, from a microbiological point of view, to say that spirochetes don't survive in deep tissue after a month of treatment is to be nothing short of a modern fool. So, touching on what we've been talking about, but also showing the passion which often presents in this debate as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who are really sick, and when you're told by the medical establishment that it's in your head, which a lot of people are being told, like, I mean, unbelievable amount of people, it's awful, right? Like, you know you're sick when you're sick, and to be told that you don't have Lyme and you might need to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist is just insulting, frankly. And I can't actually believe doctors do that, but they do. But the spirochete thing that Wendy brings up is really interesting. So there have been some studies in recent years. It's actually an NIH study going on humans on this right now, where they were actually treated, I think it was monkeys, dogs, and mice, I believe, who they infected with the Lyme virus, and they were given antibiotics and, you know, so-called cured. But then they did this really interesting scientific thing. It's called xenodiagnosis. They place an uninfected laboratory-raised tick on that animal. And that tick, that little tiny tick, is able to send out some sort of signal in that body of that animal and draw in a spirochete. So the spirochete can survive antibiotic treatment, it looks like. Is it infectious? I think that is a question right now. And can that happen? Is what they're seeing in animals can that be in humans? I mean, it's a very, very interesting question. And it's really the first time, I think, in like, it seems one of the more exciting scientific sort of lines of inquiry on Lyme going on right now. But unfortunately, because the issue is so controversial, a lot of docs in the medical establishment poo-poo that. Others are much more kind of just intrigued and said, look, we got to see where this winds up. It could be an answer or something, maybe not everything. But while others in the Lyme community feel this is the holy grail, and of course it's a persistent infection, none of those, in my opinion, based on a lot of research, none of those three points of view or anything but points of view at this point.
Let's hear now from another one of our callers. Carla is calling from Concord. Hi, Carla. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, and thank you for this very important topic this morning. I've been a sufferer for 4 years now. I have a Lyme literate doctor, and I just my point that I wanted to make was that there's such a dramatic divide between the medical community, and you've touched on this, that there are doctors who believe that there is there's gray areas and a lot to be still learned about it, but then there's another, you know, bunch of doctors too who just will not allow at all that there could possibly be such a thing as chronic Lyme. Over the 4 years, I've had episodes of having unusual symptoms, which I've come to attribute to the Lyme disease. But in some cases, my Lyme doctor has said, you know, we can't just attribute everything that you get to the Lyme. I want you to see, you know, this specialist or that specialist to have other things ruled out. And when I've gone and done that, then what I've ended up getting is a lecture from that doctor. And so what it makes you know, me fearful of is that, you know, maybe something else would develop and I might choose to not get it checked out because I just don't want to hear the lecture anymore about my not having chronic Lyme. I know I have chronic Lyme. I'm not well when I'm not on antibiotics. So I think doctors need to just allow that there's a chance until more evidence comes out and, you know, we can definitively say that the spirochete isn't killed with just a, you know, 1 month course of antibiotics.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience with us, Carla. Beth, I wanted to first ask about something that Carla, she used a term called Lyme literate,
yeah.
And that's a term that comes up here as well.
Yeah, so there's a whole, it's fascinating, there's a whole language that's developed to deal with this. You know, the Lyme community feels very rejected by the medical establishment, and so they've created their own medical association. They've created, or not them, they've created, but there's a terminology for doctors who treat patients who believe they have chronic Lyme, or the docs believe they have chronic Lyme, and they're called Lyme literate, meaning that they're literate in understanding Lyme. There's, the divide is really, really pronounced, as Carla just mentioned. The problem is, and I don't doubt that, you know, Carla has chronic Lyme, and I'm sure her doctor told her that, but the problem is, again, just getting back to the diagnosis, because the diagnosis is so bad, to settle on Lyme sometimes for some patients is not always the answer. Like, for example, my husband's cousin's wife who committed suicide, we had talks, not many, I think just one or two, about what she had. And, you know, she's very smart, like most of the people have Lyme. And she's like, I don't know what I have. The only thing I even tested remotely positive for is Lyme. So, of course, I have to sort of treat what
you
my knowledge is.
At least include
is.
That as part of the conversation,
right? Like,
right.
Am I just supposed to go through my whole life saying, I don't know what I have, but antibiotics make me feel better? Like, that's really that's the other option, right? To go through life and say, I don't know what I have, but antibiotics make me feel better. You know, at least if you test positive, even in some vague way for Lyme disease, and you feel better with antibiotics, a lot of patients land in that spot, and I probably would too, right? And so, but it does create a problem for science, at least research science, because there's the divide ultimately comes down to, do you treat the patient's symptoms, or do you kind of go by the research that shows that, you know, one, it didn't really... Long-term antibiotics for patients who had Lyme based on very strict criteria for Lyme didn't necessarily benefit overall dramatically from increased antibiotic use.
And we'll pick right back up there as we take a break here on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and Bayswater Book Company in Center Harbor, hosting 18 New England authors on Saturday, June 29th from 11 till 1. Details on Facebook and at bayswaterbooks.com. And from North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million-dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings on time, on budget, online at Facebook, LinkedIn, and at northbranch.net. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, obsessed with the Bruins, possessed by the Patriots, we'll discover the science and psychology behind fanatic sports fans, plus a beatboxing comedian and improvisational soul singer. I'm making it up as you go along.
Nothing more than so much so as to say that those within themselves, comparary or non-comparary...
I'm Virginia Prescott, Word of Mouth ad libs with Reggie Watts, today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our annual summer book show. Email us your questions and your recommendations before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for The Exchange. Today, we're talking about Lyme disease, the controversy over diagnosis and treatment. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Beth Daly of the Boston Globe, who's been working on a series of stories about Lyme disease called Bitten by Uncertainty. We have a link to Beth's series at our website, nhpr.org. Beth, just before the break, we were talking about how there are patients who say, maybe I have Lyme disease, I don't know for sure, but I know that the antibiotics make me feel better. And we got an email from Nathan who asks a question about that. He says, how do you balance the need to treat probable cases against the danger of over-prescribing antibiotics and desensitizing ourselves to their effectiveness?
I mean, that's a really big problem. I mean, that's what a lot of doctors come down to. And a lot of research doctors say, and a lot of doctors say, look, you know, we have this superbug problem going on in society where, you know, so much use of antibiotics can really make superbugs up that make hurt everyone. They see a real, real danger with long-term antibiotic use. And it's prudent. It is important danger. I think the controversy comes when it's you, right? If you don't feel good and long-term antibiotics works for you, I think while you care about society, you want to be able to get out of bed in the morning, you know? So it's a really big conflict because I think if any doctor tells someone that who's feeling better with antibiotics that they shouldn't take it because they're hurting society overall, or they could have gallbladder problems, which is a side effect of at least one antibiotic, and you know, there's obviously tons of other problems. I think it's a hard bar to get over for an individual. That said, I have talked to people who were on longer course antibiotics who felt worse on them, and in fact, many people do feel worse on them than off, at least initially. But some people I talked to took long-term antibiotics did not feel better from what they thought they had Lyme, and you know, were on for years sometimes and really messed up their system, and it was only after they went off of them they felt better. So I think there's a whole bunch of different individual cases in this big pot of Lyme that we're stirring up, and I think everyone's experience is very individual.
Let's hear from another one of our listeners. Judy is calling from Plymouth. Hi, Judy. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, everybody. Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to just say that this is amazing to listen to all of this. My husband was diagnosed with Lyme about almost a year ago now. We went through the whole doctor saying, no, you don't have it, no, you don't have it. And we finally had a recommendation to go to a doctor that practices both in Manchester and up near where we live in Plymouth. He actually is in Campden. And he said, look, I don't trust the CDC test. I use a specialty lab out in California, sent my husband's blood work out to California, and not only was he diagnosed with Lyme, but he was diagnosed with one of the co-infections that goes with Lyme, which is Babesia. There's a whole bunch of co-infections because ticks are like little dirty needles, and they pick up all sorts of things on their way around biting people. He is not currently on antibiotics because this doctor thinks a little bit outside the box and is treating him with a course of herbal remedies, which are supposed to act as little infiltrators, which kind of go in and make the Lyme more susceptible to antibiotic treatment so that people don't have to be on antibiotics for as long a time.
And how is that working for him?
It's been amazing, actually. It really has been. At first, it was like night and day, like, holy cow, you're just this brand new person. The backaches went away, the brain fog went away, and he also found out, you know, he was vitamin B deficient and a couple of other things that went along with it. But one of the issues that makes my husband kind of unique is back in the 90s, he became allergic to red meat, and they're now finding out that tick bites in certain people produces an IgA antigen that renders people allergic to red meat. And this is a new finding, so they think it's possible that my husband's been infected with Lyme since the 90s.
Wow. Well, Judy, thank you. And you've just brought up a whole host of new questions. Beth, I feel like the further we delve in, the deeper we still have to go. Well, first, I wanted to ask you about the other infections, which is something that that comes up that we know even less about than about Lyme disease.
Yeah. So this is like a really important issue, and I don't think a lot of people who have co-infections are going to. So here's the deal. Co-infections are a huge, huge problem. They really are. And a lot of people get tested for Lyme, never get tested for a panel of other things. There's anaplasmosis, there's Babesia, which is another parasite that infiltrates the red blood cells. There's something called a brand new one they just found out in the Northeast called B. myriamoidae. That's sort of a cousin to the Lyme spirochete. And something called deer tick virus, which is very rare. The problem is that when I talk, this is sort of a commentary, but when I talk to people who have Lyme, I mean, they often tell me they have every other single co-infection plus something called Bartonella. And And I say, okay, that's what your doc says. But then I look at the infection rate of ticks, and something doesn't match up. There's only like, you know, ticks are not infected as greatly with those other pathogens as they are with Lyme. About 30%, I think it's like 10, I can't even remember how many percent of nymphal ticks, the little tiny ones, that you have Lyme, and about 50% of adult ticks do. But the numbers are less for the other diseases. So I'm perplexed why so many people seem to have all the co-infections, unless they're bitten by multiple ticks. Like, there's some sort of disconnect there I have not quite figured out. So.
Now, she also mentioned that her husband has been making great progress with these herbal therapies and changes to diet, which I've also read that people are using.
I've heard that too, and I've seen while there's thousands and thousands of people on antibiotics, I know that for sure. There's a really big sort of blowback to that because people are not going to want to take antibiotics. They know they only do that as a last resort. I mean, it's not something anyone wants to do, obviously, and they are trying some herbal remedies, and some people have had really great success with them. Others have not. Same goes with antibiotics. But, I've heard some really, really good things. And, I think that's a good option for some people. If it works for them, you know, that's great.
Judy, thanks so much for your call and sharing your experience with us. Now, whatever treatment that it is that people are receiving winds up, if they have insurance, going through their insurance company. And if not, then they're paying for it out of their own pockets. Where have the insurance companies come down on Lyme disease treatment, and how does that affect this debate?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, insurance companies come down all over the place, and so does Medicaid. And so some of them don't pay for more than, like, 30 and maybe a little bit more for days of antibiotics for Lyme. Others will support a patient for much longer. Others take it on a case-by-case basis. So the landscape is very pockmarked. But the problem is these antibiotics can cost so much money. I mean, I know one person who was going to be prescribed, I think it was 5 months of antibiotics, maybe it was 7 months of antibiotics for $50,000. I mean, it is an enormous sum of money. You know, regularly $5,000 a month is not unheard of for some people. And, you know, your bank account disappears really darn quickly if insurance is not picking up some of that tab. And I think a lot of the anger of patients who can't afford the medicine that they believe is keeping them alive has created this divide that's very poisonous. I mean, some people, frankly, have become, are not acting rationally on one side of the debate. And at the same time, the medical establishment is sort of, I think, because of the vitriol, has sort of closed their ears to being open-minded in a lot of ways on this.
Well, you wrote about a man called Timothy Gray, who often appears at events by Dr. Alan Steer, the man who first diagnosed Lyme disease and has remained active in Lyme treatment. He not only shows up at Dr. Steer's events, he often interrupts them, and it's sort of the manifestation of this very contentious debate.
Yeah, Gray is not, you know, one of those unhinged people, I'd say. His sister died of what doctors said was ALS, and he's convinced was also either complicated or primarily a mold issue combined with Lyme. He's convinced of it. And he's sort of an activist type who goes around, doing what he thinks he should be doing, which is like calling the medical establishment now, and he's picked on Dr. Steer as sort of the emblem of that. That shows the emotion, and that just people are heartbroken when losing loved ones they feel could have been helped by these antibiotics. There's also like things delve into like the, you know, very unproven stage with some people too about conspiracy theories and like, you know, biowarfare that frankly I have done way too much research on. There's absolutely, I can't find anything there. But that unfortunately has made both sides sort of sit in their corners and not try to bridge the gap in some ways. So,
and as I've seen on controversial topics in the past, when you start to do that research and you start to say, well, I've looked at the conspiracy theories and I don't see much here, then you wind up almost becoming a part of the story too. Have you gotten those kinds of reactions to your piece?
The amount of reaction I've gotten, I've been around for a long time and written a lot of theories and investigations, but nothing like Lyme. You dare say that the evidence is not completely there for persistent infection. I'm branded as like in the pocket of the medical establishment. You know what I mean? And the medical establishment is mad because I dare mention that there could be a persistent infection. So, like, it goes both ways, right? You get attacked both ways. And the fact is, you know, I'm pretty objective. I know how to do my research. But it has been sort of eye-opening to see the vitriol from people. And I think I understand it because their lives are at stake, but it does not help the conversation when both sides do this.
We got an email from Donald who writes in, says, the complexity of Lyme disease shows the weakness of the healthcare system.
Yeah.
First, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, is spending only half the amount of funding needed to understand Lyme disease. No researcher trying for a positive thesis and quick progress would study it. What kind of funding is going into
Lyme research?
So,
I mean, there's some funding. I do think the Lyme community is correct that it tends to go, at least it has gone in the past, for sort of, the expected people who do that kind of research. There wasn't a lot of innovation going on. I think that's changing a little bit right now. But I should just go veer off on one thing. I mean, the money for Lyme, let's just take a step back and look at, like, public health threats and from a public health perspective and not research for a second. Public health, tick-borne diseases are like given like nothing. And you think about mosquitoes, you think about how much you hear about West Nile virus, at least in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, you hear about them a little bit, Triple E,
right.
You know, you hear about them and you hear there's going to be spraying, there's all this mosquito control going on. There's nothing like that for ticks, absolutely nothing. And it's perplexing why. I mean, there's a conversation starting in Washington right now and among states that maybe we need that kind of community-wide prevention efforts for ticks. It seems like it does because they can deliver so many more harmful diseases and ones that affect a lot more people. But there's like the money is nothing. I mean, I don't know New Hampshire, but I know in Rhode Island it's a pittance, a couple tens of thousands of dollars, same in Massachusetts for prevention. Research money is done by the NIH and other, you know, forms. And I mean, that's, I don't think, robust by any means, but it's still obviously an amount of money. What's happening, though, is the Lyme community is also a sector of it is becoming very, very smart. They're becoming politically savvy, and they're raising a lot of money to basically put money towards research they're interested in finding out, persistent infection, diagnostic tests. There's an XPRIZE right now trying to come up with a better diagnostic test. There's a center at Columbia University on tick-borne diseases that was funded in large part by the Lyme community. Very good scientists, very good, reputable. But to get it going, the Lyme community had to step to the plate and raise some money. The last thing I'd say is that the Lyme community is also becoming very politically active in passing laws in states that either require insurance companies to pay for longer-course antibiotics or protect doctors, which we haven't talked about, who have been sanctioned in some cases for prescribing longer-course antibiotics or for mistreatment of patients they diagnose with chronic Lyme.
Because that differs with the traditional approach, and then the sanctions would follow because essentially doctors are...
Yeah, I mean, the sanctions are not completely unwarranted. I mean, some of them appear to be, but, I mean, some doctors didn't do the right thing or didn't do due diligence, but, you know, many others did. It does feel like there's some sort of targeted effort going on. And I guess the only commentary I would say is that there's a lot of doctors out there that probably do wrong things, and prescribing antibiotics for like longer than a month doesn't seem to be the most dramatic of them. You know what I mean? But yet there's a lot of sanctioning going on.
And there is that shield law in this state for doctors,
right,
who are prescribing the additional treatments for Lyme. I wanted to ask, because you're still writing about Lyme disease, the series is ongoing. What are you going to look at next?
Yeah, oh, that's a great question. So the next story is going to be on prevention. And it's sort of it's an interesting story about how, vaccines and do we kill all the deer to get rid of Lyme? There's lots of interesting questions and lots of as vitriol debate about each of those things. I actually found one of the first Lyme patients in Lyme, Connecticut, a young boy who actually turned out to be a doctor, who went to a great medical school and has a really interesting view on Lyme. I'm going to be writing about him and basically about how you live with this uncertainty in your life, not knowing if something is Lyme or it's just you, you know. And then I'll be just doing something on testing to try to explain the testing to people. And these will all come out in the next few months. And I'll be doing something on persistent infection. Like, what is going on? Why do these people remain sick? What is it?
so many more questions to ask, and we've already talked about it for a whole hour. Well, Beth Daly, I wanted to say thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
That's Beth Daly. She's been covering the environment for the Boston Globe since 2001. She's won numerous national journalism awards, including being named a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2008. She's working on a series of stories on Lyme disease for the Boston Globe called Bitten by Uncertainty. You can find a link to Beth's series at our website, nhpr.org. And while you're there, we hope you'll share your experiences by posting a comment or a question. Join the conversation again at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Catherine Muzzy. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.